out.
Pop Culture Meltdown.
Episode number 5, Chris Libertini, Louis, Sweet Louis.
Oh, Louis, don't call me Louis. I hate that.
Louis.
I hate that.
Lou Pellegrino sitting across from me. We're talking to John Batchelor today.
Oh, God, can't wait.
I seriously, it's like, I mean, I'm 38 years old. I'm a man. I'm a human being living on this earth. And I cannot not listen to John Batchelor.
Oh, I know. It's great. It's absolutely fantastic just listening to this guy. I listened to some of the podcasts on my trek in from Jersey to the city.
Mm-hmm.
Those portions of when John Batchelor's on the podcast, it's like your great teachers that you remember having.
Yep.
They just have that hypnotic voice, and everything they say is just, oh my God, that's a nugget.
And they
that's
get
a nugget,
right to
and
it.
And that's a nugget. And he's just great. He's absolutely fantastic.
He's literally coming right up. But first, we want to get to very important news. Last week, they said Superman wasn't around.
You're scared of me because you can't control me. You don't. And you never will. But that doesn't mean I'm your enemy.
No more Henry Cavill. Cable.
Hey, you said it right. Congratulations.
No more Henry. Henry! Come here, Henry! I'm gonna punch you in the nose, Henry!
Hendry.
Hendry!
I wonder about you sometimes, Henry.
So they said no more Henry, and now all of a sudden...
Henry's back.
Henry's back!
Yeah.
Listen, we'll tell you when he leaves, we'll tell you when he comes, the whole deal.
Yo, what?
Exactly correct.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, let's just get to John Batchelor.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
And now it's time for news on Pop Culture Meltdown. It's A Bite with Batchelor, starring John Batchelor. Let's eat food and get knowledge.
Turning into my favorite segment that we do. Our favorite little Bite with Batchelor.
Our favorite segment. Okay, my favorite segment. I'm the only one who texts you every day. That was awesome talking with John.
Hi, John Batchelor. It's very good to see you again.
Good day, gentlemen.
Very good day to you. Let's get right to it. DeGrom, his Cy Young pace, what did he have, 12 strikeouts
12
the last time?
Against the Red Sox. Pretty good lineup.
You go into Fenway, you got to shut him down. You got no support from your own team. He knows this, okay? Mm-hmm. The pressure's on. He's facing a Boston team that can score runs by just breathing.
Mm-hmm. J.D. Martinez. And
they do.
The rest, Mookie
and
Betts.
He gives up 3 runs. He holds them to 3 runs, the Mets catch up, but they have to take DeGrom out. He's reached his pitching limit, and of course the Mets immediately managed to lose the game.
Yes.
It was my fault. It was absolutely my fault because I'm watching NFL football on an NFL Sunday, and they're playing the Red Sox, they being the Mets, and it's DeGrom against Chris Sale. I mean, no better pitching matchup, although Sale is on a pitch count. He only went 3 innings. So once that happened, I kind of lost interest in the game. But DeGrom, I can't believe when I think struck out 6 of the first 7 batters he faced, and then he gave up a single, then the 2-run home run, you know, a sack fly. It was one of those days where I'm texting my friends, he's dealing. That's when the roof fell in. But Fenway Park, 3 runs given up. He gets a no decision. Another fantastic performance, 7 innings, 12 strikeouts. I don't think he walked anybody. If he did, he walked one guy. He's locked it up, and it's not because I'm a Met fan. There's just this day and age with all the analytics and sabermetrics, they look at different things now. The win and loss column means nothing.
That's what John was saying.
I go along with that, but yeah. I also go along that I think the Mets are a drag on him. There are other candidates who are performing with teams that are soaring.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to imagine what DeGrom would be like if the Mets were winning.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
And it's funny because now they come out with the stat today. Oh, the Mets are one of the greatest teams in the second half. Blah, blah. Come on. It's, you know.
Are they playing in the second half?
I was unaware of that. I heard they're flying around the country.
All-star game. Wasn't that it?
Right. Well, the big thing is I believe they have a better record than the Yankees do in the second half. And you look where the Yankees are and you look where the Mets are. But, you know, there are Met writers and Met fans out there that have to do everything. Mm-hmm. But they always have to compare with the Yankees. And, like, they play each other, 6 or 7 times a year now. It's like, come on. Who cares?
You are a different ball team when you decide you can't win. Mm-hmm. You're looser.
Yeah.
You take more chances.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't deserve respect.
No, definitely
it's
not.
The teams who say we're going to win and then go for it.
Yeah, they do it. Like that, the Indians every
well,
year.
Well, that 86 Mets team. Yeah. That 86 in 1986 spring training, we've all heard the story. Davey Johnson said, if you guys don't think that we're just going to kick the ever-loving crap out of everyone this year, you're not going to be on this team. And what did they do? Mm-hmm. There was a four-game series in St. Louis, the team that has been the thorn in their side in the 80s for years. They went in, swept them four straight. The Redbirds did not know how to recover. The Mets just went and went and went and all the way to the World Series.
John, question for you. So we obviously love DeGrom. He's my current favorite player.
Right.
Growing up for you, did you have a favorite player? Did you follow baseball?
Jim Bunning. Jim Bunning, the Philadelphia Phillies.
Okay.
Who pitched a perfect game against the Mets on Father's Day.
I didn't get to watch television that much. This is the 18th or 19th century. It's a long time ago. However, it was that Sunday. It was Father's Day, mm-hmm. and I was allowed to watch television, and there was Bunning on the very vague black and white image. You know, that's what you had in suburban Philadelphia.
Right.
And I didn't know what a perfect game was. I really had never come up in my learning. So about the sixth or seventh inning, somebody mentioned, you know, he's got a no-hitter going, and then I learned for the first time perfect game. It was against the Mets, and it was straightforward, and there was really no—I don't remember drama from the TV at all. And afterwards, when he became a U.S. senator from Kentucky, it seemed natural to me, of course.
Right, right, of course. The two worlds collided. Yes. Right, they collided.
Yeah, he pitched a perfect game against the Mets, so of course he should be a senator.
Yeah, reminds me of Bill Bradley, right?
But it reminds me of the line from Back to the Future when Marty goes back to 1955. Well, tell me, future boy, who's president of the United States in 1985?
Ronald Reagan.
The actor? Who's vice president? Jerry Lewis? Still funny.
Jerry Lewis has got to be in the cabinet. Yeah. But so Jim Bunning. So you looked up to this guy. You saw him do something absolutely amazing.
After that, he was revered in Philadelphia. Mm. Right.
Almost godlike.
And that was the Philadelphia Phillies year to break every heart, whoever paid attention to the Phillies. And I left the Phillies after that. I left them.
That was it?
Yeah. I wasn't going to let that happen twice. What came up in 65 was the Red Sox. So that was my introduction to the American League.
Okay.
I knew the National League. The Mets were the new guys, right?
Sure.
But I knew the National League. I knew that St. Louis was always going to be dangerous and that pitchers threw 220 pitches and got complete games.
Forget it.
That
was, mm-hmm. Those were the days, rubber arms, right? The whole deal.
So the Red Sox were very good in 65, if you recall. And so I picked them up as a team just to keep my eye away from the Phillies.
Oh, that was your distraction.
So that was what? Yastrzemski? That was
the end
Williams?
End of Williams, beginning of Yastrzemski?
Yeah, right. Williams was hitting. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And
tremendous.
They were winning that year. And then by the time I got to college, it was easy to go with the Yankees because I'd learned the American League.
Of course. Sure. And the pinstripes. And you got the pinstripe suit on right now. You look tremendous.
In 69, yes. All of a sudden, this team that Bunning introduced me to decides that they're going to win. And I can recall those days going to class, waiting. They played World Series games in the daytime.
How novel.
In 69.
Oh, yes, exactly.
So I can remember going to class to lectures in philosophy or whatever it was and trying to keep my mind on the subject while the Mets game was going on outside.
Wow, yeah, I don't think I would have been able to do it.
Right.
Even when the game is on here in the newsroom, everybody's walking by. Hey, DeGrom just struck the guy out. You know what I mean?
It's so different now because I can remember my grandparents and aunts and uncles telling stories about when my grandparents were growing up in Brooklyn that you never missed a pitch of a Dodger game because everybody had their radios and they were sitting on the stoop and they were listening to the game, but every house had the game on.
That's amazing.
You could walk down the block
and
to the
hear
store
the
for your
game.
Mother and hear the entire game and come back. And my grandfather was like, I never missed a pitch. I would just go to the store for my grandmother or for my mother to get a loaf of bread or eggs or milk, and it was not like, oh, come on, I'm going to miss the game. Everybody had the game on.
Wow. It's amazing. Also, question about childhood of influences. You've obviously penned a few books under a different name. I don't know if that's allowed to be on
Twitter.
I was a literary novelist.
Literary novelist,
there's an invention where you pretend to be somebody else and uh-huh. sign somebody else's name to it, but it's your name. I mean, you're not fooling anybody. It's just a joy to write. To theoretically be writing under another person's name.
Okay, I'm with you on that.
Do you take on a different persona when that happens?
No, it's the character. It's written in the first person. So it's, I did this, I did that. And you name the first person as you would name a character if you were writing it in the third person. I wrote my first three novels in the third person, which is natural. He did this, he did that.
Right.
And then I wrote two books back to back. They were meant to be a series that I was going to continue someday, about a Cold War thriller writer who was very successful in the 1970s and 1980s, and then the Cold War went away, and he was out of work.
Yeah, like, what do you do now? Everybody went home.
He had a worldwide reputation. Everybody's waiting for the next installment, and he's lost it.
Right.
He no longer, the Russians are our friends. This is 1990, 91. And his old KGB agents, he fancied himself a conversant with the illegals. They were now entrepreneurs. You know, they were reinventing themselves because they had good English. So he was lost in a world of upside down. Of course, now, if he just waited 28 years.
Only.
Because, and I've often thought, could I put that together in my mind and go back? 28 years later, the Cold War's back. The Russians are bad guys. The CIA is clumsy.
Yeah.
But I don't think I can, but it's, that's why I wrote under a pseudonym. That's how it works.
I don't know if it's a book that was turned into a TV show or if it was just a TV show, but I haven't even watched it yet. My brother-in-law is really big into it, and I think it's called The Man in the High Castle.
And it's a story of as if Hitler had won the war.
That's exactly it. And I'm fascinated by it. I just have to find the time to get into it. What do you know about it? I mean,
I've watched enough of it to know that it eventually took over. The great idea turned into a melodrama of how is she doing? Where is he? You know, a series of subplots, which are kind of exciting. And they introduce you to Hitler living in a castle. It's a Philip K. Dick short story, short novella that they took the idea from. The original, that Dick was a very famous and persecuted science fiction writer in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and he died young, and Hollywood loves his stories. His idea was that the Japanese and the Germans had won the war and divided America into regions.
Mm-hmm.
And he concentrated his story entirely in Los Angeles, dealing with the occupation by the Japanese forces.
Yeah, and the reaction.
Who were presented as at odds with the Germans, who were the villains. And in the Amazon rewrite, and they're free to rewrite everything because Philip K. Dick just wrote a short story, the Germans again are the villains, and the Japanese are mitigated by the fact that they know that the Germans are going to take them out with atomic weapons. That's the theoretical plot of the whole story.
Okay, so it's, and like the gloomy.
But it takes place in America, and there are Quislings, there are betrayers, there are spies, there are agents, there are death camps. All of that is happening in the course of, I think they're now up to episode 7 million, so I can't possibly.
Is there like a band of rebels like in Star Wars?
The joy of Battlestar Galactica was that it ended. You know,
yes. Right. There was a beginning. There was a middle. There was an end. The Xylons come in. Right, exactly.
And at the end, they go back to. Well, okay.
We don't want to spoil the whole thing.
Extermination. Perhaps I'll like The Man in the High Castle again when it's finished.
Okay, and you just brought up Battlestar Galactica.
Report, Centurion.
So were you like a Lost in Space? Were you like a Star Trek? Were you mainly like Battlestar Galactica? Like
Tom Corbett. The books were Tom Corbett and the Space Academy.
Okay.
We didn't have television. Remember, I lived in the 18th century. We didn't have television. So there's a series of novels that were written, and I remember the man's name once, but I don't now. They were written for teenagers, young people.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Corbett and his allies, his friends, were at the Space Academy. And then they have adventures on rockets around the solar system. That's what introduced me to science fiction.
And that took you away to just
Well, you read
every
science
place.
Fiction in those days. You didn't have video. You didn't have television. You certainly didn't have an iPhone.
Right.
So on non-school days in the summertime or on the weekends, I would march to the drugstores that were about a mile and a half, 2 miles away, where they would get a rack of paperback books, because all science fiction in those days was paperback.
Yeah.
Avon, as I recall, Avon was the publisher. They would put one science fiction story on one side, you'd flip it over, and there'd be another one read back on the other side.
I remember
those.
Those
are all collector's items now.
Right.
And that's what, Those of us living in the 18th century, that's I remember how we got our science.
And I should say, I remember seeing them. I remember hearing about them and seeing them. You can find them still because there were some drugstores that actually carried paperback books, and they would do that. They may have also been some, you know, soap opera dramas that were written the same way, but I do remember the reverse of the book being, once you got to one end of the book, you just flipped it over, and there it was printed the proper way. It was great.
So, and that's where I was introduced to the science fiction writers who are now... in the pantheon of science fiction writers. But in those days, they were just writing for paperback houses, and they would turn them out every 2 months or 3 months. There'd be a new issue.
Amazing.
And it would be about stories we recognize today, you know, being on a long voyage in an intergalactic vessel where everybody has forgotten what the mission was. And so they live in an enclosed world where things are breaking down, and they have political contests, but nobody knows why we're here, where we come from, or where we're going. So at the end, you know, there it's a 70 or 700-year voyage, and generations have passed.
Right.
So the stories like that, which are routine now in movies.
Oh, yeah.
And one of my favorite songs is a song called 39. It's by the band Queen, and Brian May wrote it and sung it, and it's about space travel, and so it's called, like, you know, the Voyagers set sail. They go out into outer space, they come back, and he comes back and talks to who he thinks is his wife, and it turns out that many years have passed since he's been on this planet, many years has passed since he's been in space, but he only thinks it's been a year. So he comes back and he's talking to a lady, and the lady's eyes look familiar, but it's not his wife, it's his daughter.
It's amazing.
And it's just one of those, like, amazing stories when you listen to it. It's
right.
Like, wow.
And in the 18th century, that was surprising.
Right.
Here in the 21st century, everybody goes, yeah, sure, Vine, good plot device. Who are you going to get to play the daughter? Right.
So something that I find surprising, and we just actually talked about, you actually have a expertise on, we're talking about lunar dust. The exploration of space, what they're doing is they're putting things on the moon.
Love the
they want to build
talk.
Structures. They want to eventually, what, live on the moon? Is it, right. is it possible? Is that the thought?
Not on the moon.
Okay.
The idea is that you have to live sublunar to protect yourself from the extreme conditions of the surface, which is radiation, cosmic rays, meteorites, mini-meteorites. So you construct underneath, probably in what are called lava tubes, we're discovering them, the remains of volcanic activity at one point. And the lava tubes open up into caverns where you can control your environment.
Oh.
The other difficulty you have on the moon is that the surface is made up of the regolith crust, which is extremely toxic and extremely dangerous to human beings. So you don't want to be anywhere near it. You want to get it off of it. If you go out, you've got to get it off of your spacesuit. You can't touch it. You can't inhale it. It's very dangerous. So going sublunar would permit us to control the environment. And that is the plan.
Okay. And how close do you think this is to actually happening? They're talking about Bezos has got money into it. Elon Musk has got money into it. I mean, what is the, obviously that's the end game. But
the Chinese are committed to lunar colonies
because
they want to shed the idea that they were inferior for 100 years.
Okay.
All right.
Right.
The Qing dynasty and the great humiliation. So the Chinese are committed. Does private money have the wherewithal to sustain a competition with the Chinese? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Certainly stunts are available, but for maintaining a colony that requires state coffers, or in the case of the Chinese, non-transparency so you can take risks.
Do you think that we value space exploration anymore here?
The culture does.
Okay.
The U.S. government, though, has carried the burden, and NASA has become an ungainly bureaucracy, which is carrying enormous costs from the retired people, the health costs, enormous costs, and can't possibly compete with commercial space. So commercial space, Bezos is one of them, Musk is another, there are lots of them. They're converting what you can into monetizing space, rocket boosters that are reusable, low Earth orbit with nano and mini satellites for specific commercial clients, all of that. They'll monetize low Earth orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Monetizing the moon, though, seems not at this point practical.
Right.
The dream is there.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need the moon before Mars? That is also a debate. Going straight to Mars, the plan for the moon is you practice on the moon what you are going to need on Mars.
Right.
However, You know, Columbus didn't practice in the Azores, right? Okay, fine. He went for it.
Yes. Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Which planet interests you the most? Like, which one do you know the most about, and which one would you want to get as much information as you possibly can?
We can live on Mars. We can do that. We could recreate conditions on Mars. Mars is a failed planet. At one time, it started out like us, but it didn't quite make it. We can reproduce conditions that allow us to live on Mars. The rest of the planets in the solar system, everything is unique. Everything is different. I've learned that in reporting on the solar system discovery. These are the golden years of discovery. We didn't know anything in my youth. Now we know what we don't know, which is a lot in the solar system, but all the planets are available. So Mars, number one, because I can relate to it as a human being. Mm-hmm. After that, it's up to the robots.
What are your thoughts on dark matter? I mean, obviously, we could probably talk for 45 minutes on dark matter, but you have to go somewhere.
It's a fabulous theory. Fabulous theory. It explains a lot. Mm-hmm. And I hope we find out what it's made of or what exists.
It's pretty interesting. Like, I always watch these documentaries. I have a hard time sleeping, so I watch the dark matter.
So somebody that wired has a hard time sleeping.
The Hadron Collider. All this, what they're doing here, they're trying to, just like you said, the moon is a test for Mars. So then they'll do stuff here and with the Hadron Collider that they'll try and create matter, I'm guessing?
Well, they were looking for the explanation for our atomic theory of the universe to validate it by discovering certain particles that had to exist, but they never found them.
And they try to recreate them.
Right. In conditions that are consistent with the early universe. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But they've yet to be successful in that.
Well, they found what they were looking for.
Okay.
They found a validation of the theory of the formation of matter, of us. Mm-hmm. But matter is only a very small, matter and energy are a very small part of the universe. That's why we have these things called dark matter and dark energy, because it used to be known as the missing universe. We could only explain about 4 or 5%. I can't remember 4 or 5% of everything. Mm-hmm. What was there? We couldn't see it. Well, we still can't see it, but we have an explanation.
Do you think that they looked at it one day and they just went, "What's that? I don't know. It's dark. Yeah. It's got to be some kind of matter. Dark matter.
Dark energy. I do not recall, but there's no reason to believe it wasn't that straightforward.
Yeah,
we've got to call it something.
Because I mean, even when they identify planets, what they originally call them, PX-172 or whatever it is, or whoever discovers it, beryllium-9 or whatever, the whole thing fascinates me. And just getting back to the lunar dust, I mean, do you think it is a real world actually happening? Like living on the moon,
Yes, we can sustain a colony on the moon. We can, yes, yes. There's probably water to extract from the crust, yes. It can be sustained, very expensive.
Do you think it would need like a planetary alignment where everybody on this Earth got together and said, here's what we're doing? Kind of like you putting up the best of what you have as a planet?
If we find a way to monetize the moon, we can monetize the asteroids. We could probably monetize Mars, but I don't know about monetizing the moon. The moon is really a planet. It's the largest moon in the solar system. It's really discontinuous with all the other moons. And there's the theory of the formation of the moon is that it's ripped out of the Earth because of a collision with an ancient rocky and wet planet that hit the Earth, mm-hmm, and tore open a piece of the Earth, and it reconstituted itself into the moon. That's the original theory. It's not been completely confirmed, but it's the working theory right now. So the moon is not like other planets. It's the remains of a catastrophe. It's not like other planets, and that's why I hesitate about incorporating that into some kind of permanent colony. Okay. It doesn't. Mars has conditions that we could live with a lot of money. With a lot of money. But it has elements that would permit us to manufacture on Mars. I do not know if the moon is comparable. And again, that regolithic dust it's like living on a poison.
John Batchelor, thank you very much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen. And we didn't get to Syndergaard. Next time.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. We'll get to Thor next time. John Batchelor, thank you so much. We'll see you soon.
Right.
Listen, I'm speechless. Every time the guy delivers,
he's amazing.
I swear to you, I could listen to him for hours. Mm-hmm. Read the phone book.
Here's the phone book.
I mean, my God. He knows a lot. about everything.
But he's a cool dude too.
That too.
Like he's
love the pinstripe suit, love the bow tie.
Yeah, he's so put together. He's a smart guy.
Yeah.
You talk to him and he goes, "Oh yeah, by the way, sci-fi." And he makes jokes. He cracks jokes. He's like a vaudevillian
God,
comic.
It's amazing. It's
trapped in like
amazing.
A news guy body, trapped in a sci-fi guy body. Like it's like there's so much stuff that goes on there. That you could just seriously go, we only have 25 minutes. Let's jam in every possible question.
I know. I would sit and talk with him for 3 hours. You know, we're going to do that one day. We're going to actually sit down and talk with him for like an hour and just break it up into two podcasts. And it's just going to be like, you know, our week with Bachelor.
Yeah.
Bachelor party.
I've realized he's never Bachelor party. That's amazing.
Yeah, let's have a Bachelor party.
See, Lou, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to solo.
Right,
I'm
out.
That's it.
I'm out.
This is Lou's last episode.
Leave on a high note, everybody.
He's not getting any better than that. But legitimately, John Batchelor's tremendous. We told you about Superman earlier. He was going. Now he's coming. And Louie's putting on his bag because he's got to make his train. So we're going to wrap it up.
Pop like Superman, I'm going to change and run.
That's it. We'll see you next time. We got
Kevin Burkhardt. Yeah, man. KB.
KB.
Love KB.
Fox Sports. Fox Sports 1 right now. He does the baseball. He does the football.
NFL There's, on Fox. Yeah, MLB on Fox. Yeah, He's all over.
Not much he can't do.
But we knew him when he was little Kevin Burkhardt.
Little Kevin Burkhardt. So we're going to take you through. We're obviously going to talk baseball. And he's a huge 80s pop culture guy.
Love it.
And 90s and now. So we'll see you soon.
Yes.
All right.
Pop Culture Meltdown.
If you'd like to email the show, email popculturemeltdown@gmail.com and find us on Instagram at popculturemeltdown. Find John Batchelor on The John Batchelor Show every weeknight on Westwood One and follow on Twitter at The Batchelor Show. The voice of Pop Culture Meltdown is Dan Kelly, voice talent and one of the best human beings on the planet. For bookings, go to dankellyvo.com. Special thanks to myself, producer Laura Ponte, our graphic designer Ricky Soto, Tim Einkel with OG, and of course, the man, the myth, the legend, Chris Rudsky. This has been Pop Culture Meltdown with your hosts, Chris Libertini and Lou Pellegrino.
They are intelligent. They are smarter than the most up-to-date supercomputers. We cannot underestimate it.